This is the Takeaway Podcast for Monday, August 17th, 2015. This is the Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening, and let's get everyone moving here on a lazy summer Monday, and I mean you.
From now on, you're Private Snowball. Do you like that name?
Yes, sir!
The voice of a Marine Corps drill sergeant from the movie Full Metal Jacket. Classic, insulting, toughening, demeaning, very male. By January of 2016, though, all of the services are going to have to fully integrate men and women into combat roles. That means women are going to have to be hearing something like this in training, and that's happening right now.
You little scumbag! I got your name! I got your ass! You will not laugh! You will not cry! You will learn by the numbers! I will teach you! Now get up! Get on your feet!
More than 230,000 women need to be combat ready. Here's former Secretary of Defense Leon Panetta.
Our purpose is to ensure that the mission is carried out by the best qualified and the most capable service members, regardless of gender and regardless of creed and beliefs. If members of our military can meet the qualifications for a job, and let me be clear, I'm not talking about reducing the qualifications for the job. If they can meet the qualifications for the job, then they should have the right to serve.
And perhaps another way of saying that is...
Sir, yes, sir!
Private Joker, why did you join my beloved corps?
Sir, to kill, sir!
So you're a killer?
Sir, yes, sir!
Let me see your war face!
The Air Force is the most integrated of the military services, with 99% of positions open to women. The United States Special Operations Command is the least integrated. And the beloved Corps, the Marines, are just above that, with only 67% of positions open to women, according to a July 2015 report from the U.S. Government Accountability Office to congressional committees. Since January of 2013, the Army has been the most effective ground combat service in opening positions to women. As of March 2015, more than 68,500 roles had been opened. The Marine Corps has the fewest positions open at just 6,000. The services have some discretion here. They can opt to keep certain positions closed to women based on performance, and the Department of Defense has no plans to continue monitoring the service's integration efforts after January of 2016. Lieutenant Colonel Kate Germano was a commanding officer of the 4th Recruit Training Battalion at Marine Corps Recruit Depot at Parris Island, South Carolina. She believes passionately in achieving parity between men and women in combat when she was dismissed from her post at the end of June. Lieutenant Colonel Germano had ramped up efforts to improve the performance of female recruits, recognizing the time pressure before the 2016 deadline for integration. Female candidates were, she says, performing far below their male counterparts all across disciplines. She says commanders were tolerating it, so she got tough. And she says getting tough is what got her fired. At the end of June, the commander of Parris Island, Brigadier General Terry Williams, removed her from command, saying he had lost trust and confidence in her ability to lead. But Lieutenant Colonel Kate Germano says the Marines either don't want to meet the 2016 deadline or they aren't taking it seriously.
I would start off by saying, obviously, I'm speaking on my own behalf, and my view doesn't necessarily represent the official Marine Corps position. But based on my experiences over 19 years, both on recruiting duty and then at the recruit depot, mainly what I've seen is that there's a philosophy of sort of the soft bigotry of low expectations and a benevolent sexism, if you will. Betty Friedan once said something about, you know, women shouldn't expect special privileges because of their sex, but nor should we just accept discrimination. And I think, unfortunately, with a combination of those two things in the Marine Corps, that leads to bad things.
So what it leads to is a sense that women don't have to be as tough as men in the Marine Corps because men are, for one reason or another, loath to push them.
I think that, and then even worse, because we're putting women in combat, I think the other perception is that there should be an expectation for lower performance right off the bat for women. I think that if you look at the caliber of women that we are enlisting today, you will find that perhaps changes need to be made in how we are recruiting them. And then we need to adjust the training standards and requirements. And I think if you focused on the recruiting and the training aspects, it would be very productive both for the Marine Corps and also for the nation.
So what did you do to try to address this question in your own command at the women's boot camp at Parris Island?
one of the first things that I did when I got to recruit Depot Paris Island was I assessed the effectiveness of my command. And what I found was that our responsibility was to make every female enlisted Marine in the Marine Corps. It's the only place where female enlisted Marines are trained. And when I looked at the statistical data from the previous decade on how the female recruits had performed, what I found was that in almost every instance, they had underperformed compared to their male counterparts. And there are three other male recruit training battalions on the recruit depot. The males, their battalions are located on the depot in close conjunction to each other. And obviously, male recruits see each other all day long, and they at times interact with each other. The females, the Marine Corps has always prided itself on having segregated training, and they don't like to call it segregated training for good reason, but they have always had separate training facilities for women. And my battalion was in an area of the depot that was well far away and very removed from the male battalions. And so it's not that the language and the conduct of the drill instructors isn't aggressive as it is with the males, as much as the difference is that there is such a distinct line in the sand between males and females throughout training.
How did you try to address that? And when did you first begin to realize that you were really ruffling some feathers up the chain of command?
So the first hike that I did was for the Crucible. And the Crucible is sort of the culminating event for a recruit's experience. It's the event that they're required to participate in for about 2 days with very little food, very little sleep. And it's designed to test them and test all of the knowledge and skills that they've gained, hopefully, through the recruit training process right before they earn their Eagle, Globe, and Anchor and become Marines. And what I found during that first hike was that the females conducted the Crucible completely separate from the males, but we also hiked by ourselves to the same location where the males would meet us for the Eagle, Globe, and Anchor ceremony. I had clocked using a GPS the distance of the hike that we were conducting, and it ended up being shorter than the requirement that was in our directive for the conduct of the Crucible. And I also thought that it was inappropriate that we were completely separate, because when you become a Marine, which is at the ceremony at the end of the Crucible, the very location where we link up with the males, that should be not the first time the males and females have stood next to each other during recruit training, in my opinion.
So you would want women and men to be side by side so that if there is a disparity in performance and physical conditioning between men and women, that women would see that and push themselves to equalize that, and similarly men would do the same.
Absolutely. And I firmly believe that to be the case, knowing my own performance on the physical fitness test. If I see someone in front of me, it doesn't matter if they're male or female. I'm going to run faster and I'm going to push myself further. And unfortunately, when you're only training with females and the females who are being recruited are not in as good a shape, comparatively speaking, as their male counterparts, generally, you're only going to push yourself to the limit that you see the other females that you are training with push themselves. And so I think we're setting ourselves up for failure right from the get-go if we expect, one, the Crucible to be segregated, or two, the Crucible hike to be integrated, and that's the only training event that we have in the 13-week process that is integrated.
Now, let's talk about some specific instances. Do you believe that the women in your command turned on you at a certain point?
I believe that there was a specific group of Marines who were not receptive to change and did not like my leadership style. And when we talk about the concept of sort of benevolent sexism, my problem with that is that what I saw was that the senior leadership was very, very willing to step up for those individuals as sort of protectors without looking into the totality of the circumstances. And so I was told I was too aggressive, I was too blunt, I was too direct, and that I sounded pompous when I offered advice on recruiting, despite the fact that I had been there twice and I was very successful. And I, in my career of 19 years, what I found was that my counterparts would not be told those things.
Have you ever heard of a man being told he was too direct, too blunt,
no,
too aggressive?
Never. Never.
Do you think that a man who had done the very same thing in your situation at Paris would have been dismissed?
Absolutely not. And I will tell you that my concern and my experience has been that females, again, tend to circumvent the chain of command to talk about how they perceive problems and issues more so than males do. And so it's a double-edged sword, if you will.
Aren't you sensitive about accusing all women of being sort of whiners and manipulators here in that charge?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, if that were the case, I would be insinuating that I was a whiner, and I don't believe I am. What I will say is that 2/3 of my Marines were incredible. I would actively seek to work with them again. I was very, very sad to have to leave them, and I felt like it was a work interrupted because we were on the path to doing such amazing things. But I will also say, after 19 years in the Marine Corps, I have seen the stellar performers who are completely dedicated to the concept of being a gender non-specific Marine. And I've also seen the opposite, and that's what concerns me about this topic.
What's your relationship with Colonel Jeffrey Foltz?
He's the chief of staff at the Recruit Deep. I really don't have a relationship with him.
Because I want to run by a quote from the New York Times. He says, this whole thing started when her Marines, her female Marines, were telling us they were being mistreated. She was telling them their male counterparts will never respect them if they don't get good physical scores, and you just don't do that. What's he saying here? I can't quite figure that out.
I can't quite figure it out either. What I can say is that what I would tell both my Marines and my recruits is that if you're running in the back of the pack and you're senior to your Marines and you're expected to lead them, then if they're all running past you, you're going to have a hard time demanding of them what you're not demanding of yourself.
So on the battlefield, you're not going to be able to function, ladies, if you don't prove to these men that you're not wusses. That's sort of the principle here, right?
I would say if you take the metric of shooting and qualifying on the range, it's a perfect allegory to that. When I got to 4th Battalion, one of the most disturbing statistics that I found was that our female recruits for over a decade had underperformed on the rifle range to the point where approximately 1/3 of each class was going unqualified. This was compared to their male counterparts of less than 5 to 6%. And this was every single time we went to the rifle range. And every Marine is expected to be a rifleman. That's our slogan. And yet we weren't seeing that with the female recruits. And so by working towards improving our rifle range scores, we were able to improve the credibility of those individuals and make them more combat effective. And in just about a year, we were able to go from an average qualification rate on the depot for females of between 68 to 72% all the way up to almost 92% just by demanding more from them.
Based on your experience, what's the thing you most fear happening if after 2016, in the integration scenario, men and women are in combat together and, you know, things sort of unravel? What's your worst fear based on what you've seen?
To be frank with you, my worst fear is that we won't even get to that point. My worst fear is that the women in the Marine Corps who do desire to go into combat arms fields will be waived from the ability to do that because the Marine Corps will go into the Secretary of Defense in January of 2016 and say that we're going to ask for a waiver.
So then you're saying that the Marines are setting women up to fail.
I'm not saying that. I'm just saying that there's a lot of data being put together right now, and that data tends to focus on physical fitness. But again, it's the tail wagging the dog. If you think about it from the perspective of who we are recruiting actively and how different the caliber of applicant is on the whole, females compared to males, I think what you'll see is unless we fix what's happening before they get into the training pipeline and improve their physical fitness and their mental strength, we are going to struggle to get to a point where the data would say or show women are capable of filling these combat arms roles.
Then, just I'm going to come at this again, it sounds like the Marine Corps, for one reason or another, has created a situation where it's going to be a fait accompli, where they're basically assembling a case to say women don't belong in combat by deliberately lowering the bar for recruits and then training, and then maintaining segregation. Is that a fair characterization of your experience?
I think it will be really interesting to see what happens in 2016.
Lieutenant Colonel Kate Germano is a former commanding officer of the 4th Recruit Training Battalion at Marine Corps Recruit Depot, Parris Island, South Carolina. Thanks.
Thank you so much.
Here's what the Marine Corps told us when we reached out to them. In response, Colonel Jeffrey W. Fultz, Chief of Staff at the Marine Corps Recruit Depot that oversees Parris Island, said, quote, "We expect our leaders, women and men, to accomplish the mission while taking care of their people. Being overly aggressive and creating a harmful or toxic environment is never acceptable." Lieutenant Colonel Germano was relieved due to a loss of trust and confidence in her ability to serve in command following numerous formal and informal complaints from her Marines, officers and enlisted, not recruits, and a command investigation. The investigation substantiated Lieutenant Colonel Germano abused her authority and lacked the ability to maintain the working relationship required to effectively lead. The decision to relieve a commander is never taken lightly, but in this case it was deemed necessary. Our people, Marines and recruits, deserve a constructive command climate that fosters good order and discipline.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Curious.com, featuring personal learning consultations to help people learn more than 17,000 skills, like tennis, test prep, and tango. Curious.com. Grow your skills. Learn more at Curious.com/PRI. And LegalZoom, offering resources to help ensure the last wishes of individuals are upheld through last wills, living trusts, and powers of attorneys. Legal help is at LegalZoom.com.
Local politics is on the minds of the people of New Hampshire as the issue of drug abuse is the number one issue for the people of the Granite State. There's been a steep increase in heroin use and deaths in much of the nation, especially in New England and some of the other northeastern states. The death rate from overdoses has quadrupled in the past decade, according to a report from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. How does Mayor Ted Gatzis raise the issue of heroin in his city of Manchester, New Hampshire, when presidential candidates come into his office? Simple. He says it's the first thing out of his mouth and the mouths of every one of his constituents these days.
Well, every time a presidential campaigner stops into my office, I talk to him about the heroin epidemic that's not only in this city, in this state, but in this country. And if we don't do something to correct it, I think it's going to be the demise of this country. Because in Manchester alone, since January 1st to June 30th, we've had 50 deaths because of heroin.
And what do you attribute this spike to?
Well, I think it's because of the opiate prescription drugs that are written, and certainly when they can't get anybody to write the prescription, it's cheaper to go out and get a finger of heroin than it is to try and track down the drugs.
Do you connect the availability of heroin with the record opium harvest in Afghanistan, something the U.S. has not been able to control despite billions of investment in Afghanistan?
Well, I see it on the local level, and I really don't look at the broader issue. I just try and look at it here locally and see what we can't do to find some changes. And, you know, right now we're running a campaign in the schools that I've got somebody to donate book covers that say on the book covers, "Not even once." We've been working very hard to find the funding for a drug court here in Manchester. We've got to find ways to curtail the inventory from coming into the city and into the state. We need to find programs to get folks help. We need to start education at a young age so that students understand that it, as I say, not even once, because you can die from it.
Although, you know, parents will tell kids that heroin is really awful and you get the horrible experience or the horrible picture in your mind of the junkie on the street. And yet OxyContin is available for young people now. And kids look at that and say, well, it's safe for me to take something out of a prescription bottle. Here, I'll just use my parents' prescription and have a wild weekend.
Well, I can only tell you that I find that the movement of the FDA to make it available to younger people is absolutely absurd when we see what's happening in this country. And I would hope that people in Washington take another look at that, because that makes no sense to me at all. We see an epidemic, and yet we want to lower the age of availability to those folks, and that makes no sense at all.
Now, Mayor, I don't want to belabor the point, but that gets back to the issue of why can't the government do anything on the supply side? The FDA is granting more availability to OxyContin to young kids. There's certainly an availability issue for adults with doctors prescribing and no apparent penalties for overprescription, or at least no strong enforcement. And outside of the prescription drug issue, you've got this record harvest coming from Afghanistan through North Africa straight into the United States. It seems to me the supply side is something that is the federal government's responsibility. You've got enough to deal with the demand and rehab and all the sort of corrective measures. You're playing catch up there in Manchester.
Well, John, I can only tell you that about a month ago, we had taken 22 keys of heroin off the streets on one bus that led us to three or four different suppliers. That's 123,000 hits of heroin that came off the streets. The police department here in Manchester have been doing a great job with state police and DEA, not only here in Manchester, but other communities in Massachusetts. And the big factor is, as the chief will tell you, that we cannot arrest our way out of this. We must do everything in our power to bring this to the forefront, have conversation about it, change the prescription drug patterns of patients, and do something about education.
What candidate excites you most in terms of their sincerity and seriousness about this?
Well, they all come in and they are all very concerned, because not only they may have younger family members, but they understand what the impact is across this country. And when you take a look at it, it's, as I said, it's not just here in Manchester. I think everyone it truly affects them emotionally. And when they hear it, there is passion in their voices when they speak about it. Governor Christie has gone to a couple of different events. Kali Free Arena has sat in this office and told me about her daughter who passed away of an opiate overdose. And certainly, I think those are things that we have to listen to and we have to understand. And John Kasich gave me some things that they're doing in Ohio about how they are taking the box off an application and helping heroin addicts at another opportunity once they're cleaned up. So everybody is talking about it. People have different ideas. Governor Bush out of Florida has some good ideas that he's given to me that we can talk about. Everybody has a passion for it. Everybody understands it. There is no silver bullet, and we will continue to talk to heighten the level of what's happening in this great country.
What's the most heartbreaking story on your side locally that the chief of police has told you about in terms of getting to a location too late, or not being able to intervene in time on some addict who had a bright future but for this drug?
Well, it's not only the stories I hear from the chief, but it's people that walk into this office and a mother that comes in and says, "Mayor, we have to do something about this. I can't find my 16-year-old son any place for rehab. I walked into his room on Saturday and he had a needle in his arm." The most disturbing part of that whole discussion was how young the child was. And that's what I'm seeing. I'm seeing that younger folks thinking that this is a new high, that they can get involved. But again, as I said in the very beginning, John, this is about not even once. Because if you do it once, you can die. People that are cutting heroin with fentanyl, law enforcement should be looking at them as certainly attempted murder victims, because they know that people can die with what they're doing. If I told you that there were 50 deaths in a seven-month period, you'd tell me that there was probably a serial killer running around the streets of Manchester.
Well, Mayor Gatsis, thank you so much.
John, you have a great day.
Mayor Ted Gatsis is mayor of Manchester, New Hampshire, stumping the issue of heroin addiction in Manchester and around the country to the candidates who are very, very interested in New Hampshire as that primary helps to kick off the 2016 season. Thanks again, Mayor.
Thank you.
The Takeaway is supported by Citrix, creator of GoToMeeting, connecting people and businesses in face-to-face online meetings from any device, featuring a personalized meeting room for a custom look. Learn more at GoToMeeting.com.
Common techniques are litigation, organization, mobilization, coalition. That's what has brought us as far as we've come, and that's what's going to take us in the future. Now, the particulars may be different or new, but the basic fight always remains the same.
Civil rights leader Julian Bond died on Saturday at the age of 75. The erudite academic, son of a college president. He was heir to the intellectual traditions of W.E.B. Du Bois and Frederick Douglass.
There's still enormous disparities between blacks and whites in education, income, life expectancy. The list just goes on and on and on. And so while gaps between blacks and whites have narrowed, most of them have not closed.
Julian Bond was not merely an intellectual. In his fierce confrontation with authority, he faced down police and thugs at sit-ins and demonstrations in the 1960s. His parents insisted that he have an academic career, but he quit school to join the protests of the 1960s and became a founder of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee and helped found the Southern Poverty Law Center.
When we speak of dissent, we usually speak of causes, good causes and evil causes. We speak of men who do not like the way their lives are lived or do not like conditions imposed upon them. They then dissent, and we applaud or we draw back, depending upon our own positions in relation to the dissenter's life.
Bond was chairman of the NAACP from 1998 to 2010. Bond was elected to the Georgia legislature in 1965, and at the chaotic Democratic National Convention in Chicago, his name was placed in nomination as vice president.
We offer in nomination with the greatest pleasure the name of Julian Bond.
What's at work here? Wisconsin has placed your name in nomination for what purpose?
Well, I would hope it's because they think I'd make a good vice president. I think it's also to get an opportunity to address this body and through the medium of television other people in the nation about some of the issues that are not being discussed here.
Which are
poverty, racism, war. There really have not been a great deal of free discussion about them, I don't think.
Julian Bond, a fighter and a gentle conscience of the civil rights movement to the end. Representative Calvin Smyre knew Bond in Georgia, serving two terms with him in the Georgia House beginning in 1975.
Well, Julian Bond was a very unique person. Not only did he have the intellect, but he had the courage, and he had a special way of articulating it. And I can remember my first time meeting him in 1974. He was an individual that I knew would go on to do higher things in life. He was a very articulate, very much an intellect, but very articulate in ways of expressing himself.
He had a curiously non-ideological view of history, it seemed to me. He wanted to go where change could be made, and that, of course, explains his role in SNCC, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. That explains his helping to found the Southern Poverty Law Center. It also explains that he would do an interview with Clarence Thomas, when perhaps not many other people in his leadership role in the civil rights movement would do such a thing. He viewed history as something that one should know about without maybe judgment.
Julian Bond could articulate his side of the story, but he never backed away from difference of opinion. He never shut down listening to the other person's side of the story. So he was one of those types of person that intellectually he could grasp all of that and dissect it. And his methodology was that way. He would gather everything in and then dispense it out in a way that he tried to put it where everybody could understand it. So he was a very, very phenomenal person. I'm just so sad to learn of his passing, and he gave much to our state and gave much to our country.
George Representative Calvin Smyre, thank you so much.
Thank you very much, John, for being. I'm happy to be with you today.
We felt we were doing wonderful work. We felt we were changing the country for the better, and that even though it was hard work and sometimes dangerous work, we were happy to do it and eager to do it. Even closer than I am with the people I went to high school or college, I'm closer with the people I was in the movement with.
The quest to find and grow trust among African Americans in the criminal justice system has motivated a broad and deep look at traditional practices which may not have originally had racial implications, but now find themselves under new scrutiny to avoid explosive verdicts in police brutality cases and other highly watched cases. The long tradition of what's called the peremptory challenge, where lawyers may remove a prospective juror for any reason, may explain why an overwhelming percentage of blacks have been removed from cases in certain districts in the South and around the country. One study has looked at two parishes in Louisiana and judicial districts in North Carolina and Alabama. They all found peremptory challenges responsible for significantly altering the racial composition of juries. Adam Liptak, Supreme Court correspondent for our partner, The New York Times, is with us. Adam, what's the math here? Do it. And it does have an impact on verdicts, yes?
It sure looks that way, yeah. So in general, lawyers get a certain number of peremptory strikes, meaning they can exclude from juries people for any reason. They don't have to offer a reason. And it turns out that prosecutors in several parts of the country where this has been studied exclude blacks twice as often, sometimes three times as often, as prospective white jurors. And a new study from Caddo Parish, which is where Shreveport, Louisiana is, seems to show that it really matters in verdicts. That is, if you have two or fewer blacks on a jury, you get no acquittals, and we're talking about overwhelming sets of black defendants. And if you have three or more, you get 12%, five or more, 19%. So if you have a representative sampling of the community, you're more likely to have a justice system which gives you both kinds of verdicts, guilty verdicts and acquittals, and not only uniformly guilty verdicts.
All right, let's talk about the source, the sort of case law source of peremptory challenge. It goes back to English common law, if I'm not mistaken, yes?
Yes. Now, we've had this for centuries, and until 1986, the Supreme Court said that's the way it is. Both sides get peremptory challenges. They don't have to explain themselves. Trial lawyers say they like to operate on instinct. They don't may not even have a reason. But in 1986, the Supreme Court said we're so opposed to racism in the criminal justice system that if challenged, prosecutors have to give a reason. That is, if they're excluding a lot of blacks and the defense lawyer says, I think he's excluding blacks because he's discriminating against blacks, the prosecutor has to give a reason. And it turns out that decision from 1986 called Batson against Kentucky really doesn't have a lot of teeth because prosecutors are pretty good at coming up with reasons and judges are very reluctant to question them to say, I don't believe your reason. You, Mr. Prosecutor, are a liar. You're a racist. So you don't have a lot of successful challenges under this Batson decision.
Now, the Foster case that's coming up before the Supreme Court may actually give Batson some teeth because it allows or potentially allows the court to look at notes and statistical sort of details that give an indication of a possible strategy on the part of prosecutors in their peremptory challenges. Can you describe this case?
Yeah, so the Foster case is a death penalty case, and decades after Timothy Foster is convicted in 1987, the prosecutor's notes surface. And those notes have race all over them. It has B next to every black person. It has the black potential jurors circled on sheets of notes. It has them highlighted in green. It has them ranked in order. It has an investigator saying, well, if we have to take one black, let's take this woman. So it's the racial aspect of it is fairly clear. And yet when challenged, the prosecutor came up with lots and lots of supposedly race-neutral reasons. You know, the jurors were confused. They didn't make eye contact, all kinds of race neutral reasons. And here's a case where the Supreme Court is, you know, more likely than not going to find that this trial was infected by racism. The larger question is, does it do anything to this general structure in the Batson case we've been talking about, which in general seems not to have a lot of teeth?
Finally, you described the way in which these notes were used. It does seem almost as though the lawyers were manipulating Batson itself, indicating that, well, if we have to take a black, we'll take this good black and these other ones we don't want. So I'm wondering if the court would view a manipulation of Batson, which was intended to create a race-neutral environment, as particularly onerous and try to do something much more aggressive here.
Yeah, I think that's quite right. The question is, what's the more aggressive move? And as I talk to a lot of defense lawyers and prosecutors, some of which like peremptory challenges, some not. Most of them didn't have very good ideas about how to make Batson better. One proposal that makes a little bit of sense is in Louisiana, for instance, both sides get 12 peremptory challenges. That's just a lot. A couple people suggested, what if it were just three? That would let them knock out someone they really are scared of, really viewed as biased, but not let them go on a campaign to take out people of one race entirely.
Adam Liptak, a Supreme Court correspondent for our partner, The New York Times. Thanks so much, Adam.
Great to be here.
If you want to catch up on that conversation or listen back to anything on the program, check us out at thetakeaway.org. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by Lumosity.com, brain training designed by neuroscientists that has been used by 60 million people worldwide, with personalized training programs to challenge memory, attention, and problem solving. Learn more at Lumosity.com. The Henry Luce Foundation, for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. The Takeaway's resilience reporting is supported by the Rockefeller Foundation. For more, go to rockfound.org.